Okay, thank you. Thank you, William. So I'm going to talk about our first year and a little bit about the sort of physics that you get at the Zepto scale. So I'm going to start with talking about a 19th century puzzle and how it impacts some of the 21st century physics we're going to do. Describe a little bit about how you would build a Large Hadron Collider, so I could then explain how you can break a Large Hadron Collider. Talk a little bit about how you detect particles in general and the experiment in general. And I'm going to then spend most of the talk on a couple of measurements. One is something we call jets and searching for things inside of quarks. Show a little bit about jets and heavy ion collisions, and finally conclude with some results on the Higgs mechanism and something we call electroweak symmetry breaking. So in 2001, there was an Age of the Earth controversy between one group and another. In 1860, there was also a bit of a controversy between two groups. On one side, you had the Helios, people like Helmholtz, and they argued that there's no way that the sun could shine longer than about 10 or 20 million years. And there's no way that the Earth could be older than the sun, so the Earth had to have the same sort of age. On the other side, you had the geologist camp led by the Darwins, and they argued that there are features in the Earth that are hundreds of millions of years old, and the Earth had to be at least as old as any feature on it. So there was this tension here. So where did Helmholtz go wrong? Well, he said, what we're going to do is we're going to take the gravitational potential energy of the sun. We've got the luminosity here, and that's going to tell me how long it can burn. And if you plug the numbers in, you get 10 or 15 million years, depending on whether you do the integral right or wrong. But we know today that gravity is not the source of energy in the sun. It's nuclear fusion. And that has 1,000 times as much energy as gravity. What you're doing is you're taking four protons, turning them into a helium nucleus, and you've got two neutrinos left over, and two neutrinos that end up being detected in Sudbury. This actually doesn't solve your problem. Right? If I add another energy source, it doesn't make the sun burn longer. What it really does is it makes the sun burn brighter. So the analogy is if you take two sticks of dynamite and stick them in your fireplace, it doesn't make your fireplace burn any longer. Although the fire will last for as long as you own your house. So getting back to the sun, so what's happening is the protons are turning into neutrons in this process. Two protons here become neutrons inside the helium nucleus. Right? And it's the weak interaction carried by the W boson which does this for you. Now, the strength of this interaction is suppressed by a factor of energy over the W mass to the fourth power. And in the sun, this is 10 to the minus 32. So this is throttling the nuclear fusion reaction so that the sun can burn for billions and billions of years. So we have sort of an answer to the question. Right? We understand why the sun shines for billions of years. It's because this guy is heavy, weighs about the same as a bromine atom. And in fact, a 5% change in the mass turns out to a factor of 2 change in the lifetime. But this opens up a brand new question. Okay, you've explained this in terms of the W boson being heavy, but why is it so heavy? And that's what the LHC is trying to find out. So let me go back to quantum mechanics to explain what the problem really is. Right? When you take quantum mechanics, you learn that the probability density is the square of the wave function. If I change this to minus psi to minus pi, everything that I can observe is totally unchanged. The next week in class, you learn that you can rewrite this better as the wave function times its complex conjugate. So if I add a phase to the wave function here, I un-add it here, or rather multiply it here, I divide it here. So again, anything that I observe remains completely unchanged. And this is just a special case of that. Now, the key idea is if I can't actually observe phi, how do I know it's the same everywhere? How do I know it's the same here, as here, as here? How do I know it doesn't change tomorrow or didn't change from yesterday? I should really allow it to be a function of position and time. Now, this looks harmless, but it turns out this is an incredibly powerful constraint on the kinds of theories you can write down. And the problem comes up because the Schrödinger equation and its descendants all are differential equations, they're derivatives, and the derivative of a product has two terms, not one. And at the end of the day, I can't have any leftover phis, they all have to cancel somewhere, because by construction, they're not observable. So if I want to write down the Hamiltonian to describe two electrically charged particles, I need to add one more piece to get rid of all of these extra phis, and that's a massless photon. Now, a good theory, let's go back. Massless, why massless? Hold on, where am I? Okay, fine. So Why does it have to be massless? A massive spin 1 particle has three spin states, m equals plus 1, minus 1, and 0. The m equals plus 1 states are transversely polarized, by which we mean that the spin is pointing in the longitudinal direction. The m equals 0 state is the longitudinal polarization, by which we mean the spin is transverse to the direction of motion. This is really perhaps the worst convention that we've adopted since we decided that current flows opposite to the direction of the electron flow. But once we've come up with this convention, I really don't want to change it. So that's what transverse is, and that's longitudinal. Now, a massless spin 1 particle doesn't have three spin states. It only has these two. And the sort of hand-wavy argument is, it's massless, so it's traveling at the speed of light, and there's no frame I can boost into to find its spin pointing in another direction. So I've really only got these two states. So to cancel all of those phis, I need just these two states, these two degrees of freedom. If I add this third one in, it overdoes it, and it screws up all those cancellations that I was trying to put in. So the photon that I add has to be massless. Now, a good theory is predictive, or at least retrodictive, but this is really theoretically impressive, right? I start with Coulomb's law, I want to fix it up so it works relativistically and quantum mechanically, and out pops magnetism, that's a relativistic effect, classical electromagnetic waves traveling at the speed of light, and a quantum mechanical photon that has zero mass. And experimentally, the photon is very, very close to massless. It weighs less than 10 to the minus 22 electron masses. Give you kind of an idea of what that is. That's 10 molecules of ethanol in a glass of water. Down south of the border where I come from, we call this light beer. It's roughly the radius of my head to the radius of the galaxy. And it's the probability Lindsay Lohan won't do anything shameless and stupid in the next year. So let's do this one more time. So the Hamiltonian charge particles, I get a massless photon. That's good. If I do the same thing with color charge quarks, I also get a massless gluon. And in fact, I get 8 massless gluons, which is the right number. And if I do this with particles with weak charge, I get a massless W plus, a W minus, and Z. Unfortunately, experimentally, they're heavy, 80 and 91 GeV. So why this doesn't work is, again, why the W and Zs are massive is what the LHC is trying to find out. Now, nobody wants something which can just do one thing, particularly if you're spending billions of dollars doing it. So one of our goals is to understand what's going on with electroweak symmetry breaking, why the photon has no mass and these other particles do. We would also like to probe the structure of matter at the very smallest scales we can reach. Small scale means high energy because the wavelength goes as 1 over momentum. We'd like to search for new heavy particles. That also means large energies. And finally, we'd like to get as many of things we've previously discovered as we possibly can for precision studies. All four of these goals require going to the highest energy that we can achieve. The LHC collides at design 7 TeV protons on 7 TeV protons. In simple, this is in principle, it's simple to do. You just put 7 trillion volts on a proton and let it go. This might not be the safest course of action. That's what happens with 500 kilovolts in air or about 1.5 megavolts in acrylic. And even in vacuum, you can't do this because the electric fields are so strong, they'll rip apart the very atoms that you're using to put this field on. So you have to do something else. So the way these accelerator works is we take a set of cavities and we put a standing RF wave in. So the electric field is sloshing back and forth here in each cavity. And we let a proton go at this point in the process. So it sees these electric field lines and it's accelerated in this direction. As it's accelerating, the field is starting to weaken and ultimately reverse. And just at the moment it reverses, we stick the proton in a little metal tube which shields it from the field. All right. Then it comes out, it just drifts through this field, and by the time it enters this cavity, it's at the phase where, again, it's ready to accelerate. So we always accelerate it by letting it feel the field as it's accelerating and then shielding it from the field as it's decelerating, and the proton goes faster and faster and faster. So, except for engineering, we've solved our problem. All we have to do is take enough of these cavities and stack them, and we're done. As a practical matter, it's not very good. If we use state-of-the-art cavities, it means that our accelerator has to be about 150 miles long. You see, I didn't get every U.S. unit out of this. I tried to get all the hogsheads and firkins out of here, but apparently this one's stuck. But anyway, it's 150 miles long, and it would cost about $75 billion. Either one. So to solve this, we recycle. We build a small linear accelerator, and we use magnetic fields to take the protons out this end, all the way around, and back through the linear accelerator. So they have no acceleration here, and we give it a little kick here. So we reuse the accelerating structures typically 20 million times during each fill of the LHC. Now, the cost of this is about an order of magnitude cheaper than an equivalent linear accelerator. The price you pay is that you're limited by the field strength of these magnets. The stronger the magnets are, the more energy I can impart to the protons and still make it come back all the way around. If I impart too much energy and the magnets can't return it, the beam goes straight and you lose it. This is a little bit less cartoonish view. This is the LHC, the various places of it. This is where it sits on a map of Geneva. So that's the CERN site. This is the city of Ferney-Voltaire, where I lived. This is the city of Cessy. This is the city of Saint-Genis. This thing is big. It's 27 kilometers around. There are 1,232 dipole magnets and about 8,000 focusing and corrector magnets that carry the beam on its path as it goes around and around and around. Now, the next problem we're going to run into is resistance. To generate that sort of field, we need about 12,000 amperes. If you look at this is a US code. It says if you want a wire that'll carry 12,000 amperes, it has to be 35 centimeters in diameter. Otherwise, it's going to catch fire on you. This is 0000 with 32 zeros gauge wire. Now, you can actually do this with shaped copper, but you probably can't even control the shape well enough. But even if you could do it with copper, the resistance is about 0.02 ohms, which means your joule heating alone is about 3 megawatts. So just to keep the machine on and doing nothing would take 3 megawatts of power. So to solve this problem, we go to superconducting magnets so we don't have resistance. So superconducting is great, zero resistance, it's a good thing. The field is limited to about 9 Tesla, and I'll show you why in the next slide. The price you pay is they have to be kept cold, just under 2 Kelvins. The Carnot efficiency of pumping this heat out is less than 1%, so every watt that you inject takes you 100 watts to take out, which means that you've got to have a heat load of less than about 15 watts per magnet. Now, the other problem you run into is when you make things cold, they shrink. Right? And that says that the LHC, when you get it cold, would shrink about 15 meters in radius when you take it from room temperature to cryogenic temperature. Unfortunately, the tunnel is only about 3 meters wide, so that won't work. So we have these various bellows that connect, and the first time we cooled it, we discovered that you could break them. So now, every time they thermal cycle the machine, they blow a little ping pong ball all the way around with a little radio transmitter in, so when it gets stuck, they can walk over to it and find which one of these bellows has failed so they can recycle it. This is good, but the problem, of course, is you really don't want to be thermal cycling your machine very often because things break. So back about superconductivity. Usually people think about the critical temperature, but in fact there are three ways you can destroy superconductivity. You can increase the temperature past its critical temperature. Now you're shaking apart the Cooper pairs. Or you can exceed a critical field or critical current. You're pulling apart the Cooper pairs. So in fact you've got a critical surface. On this side things are normal, and on this side they're superconducting. Now, because we want to run at very high fields and high currents, it means that we want to be running as close to this point as we can to get on this curve. Right? That means we'd like a very cold magnet. So even though the critical temperature for niobium titanium, which is what we make the wire out of, is almost 18 Kelvin, we want to run it at liquid helium temperatures so we're not sitting right up here where there's only zero field little support. To give you an idea of how much margin is built in, the short sample limit is 9 Tesla. That is, if I have this much wire, it'll support that much field. At design, LHC magnets are operating at 8.36. So we don't even have 10% margin built into it. This is a picture of superconducting wire. Niobium titanium is a wonderful superconductor. It's got all the superconductivity properties you might ever want. It has the mechanical consistency of toothpaste. So if you want to make a wire out of this stuff, it's really rough. So instead, what we do is we surround it with a copper jacket. It's only about 10% of the material there. But that does two things. It gives you some mechanical strength, and when the magnet is warm, it allows you to pass current through it. Remember, good conductors are lousy superconductors, and superconductors are lousy conductors. So when your superconductor gets warm, it's really very resistive. And that matters because this is what you should not do with your magnet. So suppose you've got, you're carrying current out of the page, and suppose for whatever reason a little tiny region went normal on you. All right, so it's becoming resistive, and what's going to happen? Well, now the current is going to see this resistive normal spot, and it's going to try to drive around it. Now, right at this edge, of course, you're at the critical current density. That's what the edge means. So since I'm now adding current around that, I'm making a larger region normal. Now I make a larger region normal, even more current starts flowing around it, making an even larger region normal, and so on and so on. And pretty soon, I've got a resistive spot in the wire. Now the current can't flow at all. So it suddenly stops, it suddenly becomes resistive, and I've got many kiloamps here now heating up this one tiny piece of the magnet. To give you an idea of how much energy is in the magnet, there's about 10 gigajoules at design, which is roughly the same as a 747, its kinetic energy at top speed. So you really don't want to lose all of this energy in, say, a cubic millimeter. That would be bad. So here's a little bit of what happened 2 years ago, 3 years ago now. CERN announced that the LHC would start at 5 TeV per beam rather than 7, and this was to avoid a magnet retraining process. We were all very happy. September 10th was Media Hoopla Day. They had circulated beam at injection energy, 450 GeV, and at the time, 7 of the 8 sectors were qualified to operate at 10. That means they ran the same current that would get it to 11 without any problems, and they figured, okay, we've got 10% margin here. On the 18th of September, a transformer near 0.5, that's the one farthest from CERN, failed. And EDF, Electricité de France, said it will take a couple of days to find and install a replacement. So while this happened, they were not able to have enough power to cool the accelerator, so 2 sectors started to warm up. So since they had nothing to do, and it would be days before that would happen, they decided, let's qualify that 8th and final sector for 11 TeV operations. On that day, a magnet quench led to an electrical arc, which caused a catastrophic loss of helium, which made really a great big mess. So in more detail, one of these interconnects, this is the interconnect connects the copper stabilizer to the superconducting wire here and allows you to go from one superconducting cable to another. One of them had a resistance of about 220 nanoohms, which doesn't sound like much, but it meant that we were injecting about 18 watts of heat into the helium. Worse, it was being injected into the reservoir side, not on the magnet side. And since it wasn't occurring in the magnet coils, the quench protection system didn't notice this was happening. Well, when you put 18 watts of helium of energy into liquid helium, it starts to boil. Everything warmed up, and the resistance jumped up to about a milliohm, up from nanoohms. So now all sorts of energy is going into this. Then the quench protection system noticed that this was happening, and this was bad. But about the same time, there was an electrical arc, and it punctured the helium enclosure, so we lost all of the helium. 6 tons of helium boiled, and it expanded through the tunnel with a velocity of 10 meters per second. And P equals MV, so this is essentially the mass of a truck with the speed of a truck, so it had the momentum of a truck. And you could sort of see the sort of damage that was done. So it knocked some of these magnets completely off of their stands. It just, you know, took some of these bellows and just crushed them. And we ended up with a 1-year delay. 53 magnets had to be removed and repaired, or in some cases replaced. Since the quench protection system didn't, they decided that they had to redesign it from scratch and install that. And they added additional vents to the dipole so that if they started losing helium, we would see it faster and that you'd have some place for the pressure to go before you lost it in the whole string. They then decided to lower the beam energy to 3.5 TeV per beam. This is 4 times safer than design. Remember, the power goes as the current squared. This also let them have a lower dump resistance and a faster dump, less risk. On the other hand, the physics reach was a factor of 5 to 10 lower than it had been before. So those were the pros and the cons. But we got going. So this is how much data we've taken and a log plot over time. I want to draw your attention to the fact that it was growing exponentially through all of last year with a doubling time of about 12 days. So every 12 days, we had taken more data than we had taken the entire run before. By the end of the first year, at this point here, the LHC was delivering 0.05% of the expected total data at 2% of the expected luminosity. So, you know, we're nowhere near the design of the machine. This was really giving us a taste of what was to come, but, you know, this was a certain set of data that we'd never seen before, so we're really very excited about it. So let me tell you a little bit about ATLAS. This is just to give you a sense of the size. That's a person. That's the detector. It's 44 meters long, 22 meters high. And when we have these collisions, most of the particles that we're interested in decay in a very, very short time, 10 to the minus 24th seconds. I think those are yoctoseconds. We can't detect them directly. We can only see their decay products. And one common trick we do is we take a look at the various things that come out, and we assume they're coming from a common parent, and we try to reconstruct that parent, and we plot the mass of that guy. And if they happen to form a bump, that means we've got it right. So these are the wrong combinations, and these are the right ones. The way this works in a little bit more detail is we take particles that are coming in. The first thing we do is we try and curve them in a magnetic field. That measures their momentum, right? The radius of curvature is given by this. The particles then stop in calorimeters. That measures their energy. So now we have two measurements, one of their momentum, one of their energy. And the exception are muons, which go all the way through this, and then we remeasure their momentum a second time. Right? And because different particles propagate differently through different parts of the detector, we can use this to identify what we have, whether we have an electron or something else. So let's look a little bit more closely at this. This, again, is our person. So this thing right in the middle here is our magnets and our tracking. So we measure the particle's momentum in here. This thing about the size of a house is the calorimeter. That's where we measure the energy. And everything that comes out on the outside is a muon, and it then is measured in this spectrometer over here. This is the most important component. ATLAS is composed of 3,100 collaborators in 176 institutions in 38 plus or minus one countries. The plus or minus one is China and Taiwan, both of whom are collaborators. They agree that there is only one China. They just disagree about which one it is. So let me talk a little bit about some of the science we've done. Question you might ask is, which is the better picture of matter? Is it the old ball and stick model of chemistry, where you've got indivisible particles and the properties result from different arrangements of them? Or do you have layers and layers and layers of substructure? I'll talk a little bit about the periodic table. This arises because atoms have substructure. It's because there are electrons in atoms, and it's the motion of electrons that give you the periodic table. I mean, why should sodium and potassium have similar properties at all? I mean, why? And the answer is, well, it's because of the dynamics of the electrons in them. Both have a single unpaired electron on the outside. You can do the same thing with particles. If you take the 9 lightest spin 0 particles or the 8 lightest spin 1/2 particles, they also form into these nice little rows and columns. This is because they themselves have substructure, the quarks. Well, you can look at the modern periodic table where the quarks and the leptons line up in rows and columns. Does this arise because quarks have substructure? Now, that's a good question and one the LHC might address. The sensitivity is comparable to where we found the next layer down in the past. There's a factor of 100,000 between the size of an atom, a radius of an atom, and the radius of a nucleus. There's about a factor of 100,000 in our sensitivity between the size of a quark and our final sensitivity. Now, there's a subtle factor in here. If this is substructure, its nature has to be very different than in the past. Right. The complication is light quarks are, well, they're light. That's why we call them light quarks. They weigh a few MeV, but any subcomponents have to be very heavy, at least 1,000 times heavier. Otherwise, we would have discovered them. So they have to be bound very, very deeply. So the way you would have to get substructures to have something which weighs many hundreds of GeV, another something which weighs many hundreds of GeV, bound by many hundreds of GeV, such that it almost exactly cancels, and you're left with a few MeV. Possible, but unusual, different from what we've seen before. And to remind you of something from quantum mechanics is a delta function, which is what this potential is starting to look like, right, skinny and deep, has only one bound state. So you can't use a delta function to explain why you've got this periodic table. However, I'm an experimenter. This is not my problem. My problem is to go and look and see what we see, and if we happen to find something that has a theoretical problem, I have friends who will do the calculation and explain to me why it should look like that. This, however, is my problem. I can't pluck a quark out of a proton. Right? A good analogy is a magnet. If I want to take a north pole of a magnet and stick it in my pocket, I can't. Because once I break the magnets, I end up with a north and a south pole. Same thing happens with a proton. If I take a proton and I try to pull a quark out, eventually the string that holds the everything together will break, and instead of having a free quark, I pop a quark-antiquark pair out of the vacuum, and I'm left with my old proton again and another particle, usually many particles. All right. In a little bit more detail, the force between two colored objects is roughly independent of distance. So I pull them apart and I'm putting in more and more and more energy. And eventually that energy goes into making new particles when I break the string, not in truly separating the quark from the rest of the proton. Right. So ultimately, these quarks and antiquarks end up as a collection of particles, mostly going in the same direction. And this is almost impossible to calculate. You just can't tell how often I get 10 particles of this type and 5 of that versus 9 and 6 or 9 and 2. But it turns out it doesn't matter because we weren't really interested in these particles to begin with. We were interested in the quark. So this quark is coming around. It eventually forms these other particles all going in the same direction, a jet. And if I measure the energy and momentum of this jet, because energy and momentum is conserved, I know the energy and momentum of the initial quark. So I didn't really need to know what it turned into. So summing over all of the details of the composition turns out to be a good thing. Two jets might look very different, but this allows us to treat them on the same footing because their parent quarks look the same. So here's a picture of a jet event. If I were an astronomer, you know, I'd be showing you pictures of galaxies all day. I'm interested in jets, so I can show you pictures of jets all days. This is one of them. You can see this blast of particle over here in the tracking chamber that led to energy in the calorimeter. Another one over here. This is the beam's eye view. This is a cross-sectional view where, again, you can see these jets. And in the calorimeter, you can see a cluster of energy here and another cluster of energy there. So that's the sort of thing that we look at when we study jets. Here's another case. You've got one big jet here, one big jet here, which you can see in the detector, and a little tiny one over here, and maybe a few other little ones over there. This event has many, many jets. You can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And here's one with only two, here and here. So, why are these useful? What appears to be a very inelastic process, two protons smack together and you get a big blast of particles, is actually the elastic scattering of two of the constituents. So what happens is I've knocked this red quark and this blue quark out of the protons when they collide, and they become this red jet and this blue jet. By measuring the energy and momentum of this guy, that's the same as the energy and momentum of this guy. Likewise, that guy is that. So jets are the best window we have to seeing what the quarks themselves are doing. And things that look very, very complicated when you're looking at the individual particles become very simple when you start looking at the jets. So let me draw a parallel between atoms and quarks. If I take an atom and I put a lot of energy into it, the atom will transition into an excited state. Then it'll emit a photon and go back to its ground state, and we'll see a line spectrum. So this is, I think, hydrogen, and you see four lines here. Well, what happens if I try to do the same thing with quarks? I put a lot of energy into a quark. If there's an excited state, it will transition to that state. Obviously, if there's not, it can't. Right? And then that excited quark will emit a gluon and return to its ground state. So what would we see? Right? If you plot the mass of two jets, you would see bumps. These bumps correspond to the lines you would see in atomic spectrum. Now, the reason you need two jets here is that one of the jets is the gluon that's emitted when it decites. The other is the recoil quark. You don't see that so much in atoms because atoms are big and heavy things and there's not much recoil, but these quarks are light, so when they emit the gluon, they go screaming in the other direction. So the signature is really two of these guys. So experimentally, the question is this smooth or does it have bumps? The other thing to notice is the background, which is in black, is enormous. So, you know, we're trying to measure atomic spectra outside at high noon, not in a dark room. So it's hard. We have to deal with a lot of these backgrounds, but we're just stuck with that. So this is what the data look like. And you can see the data are perfectly smooth. There's no sign of bumps or energy levels. And from that, we can set a limit. Essentially, if there was a bump out to here, we would be able to tell. So if excited quarks exist, they must be heavier than 2.15 TeV. And I want to point out that the University of Toronto made some major contributions to this analysis. It would not exist if it were not for this place. So the previous best limit was 0.89 TeV at CDF, and that was 20 years after the Tevatron started. We had enough data for an expected limit beyond the Tevatron on Monday, July 19th. That was 111 days after the first collision. On the following Friday, we showed the results, the first ones beyond the Tevatron at the IGCEP conference in Paris. So we went from, we collected the data until Monday, and on Friday we were ready to put a preliminary result out. On August 13th, the paper was sent to physical review letters. So there's two lessons from this. One is higher energy is a huge advantage. It only took us, you know, literally 113 or 14 days before we were able to show something. And the other is that big collaborations are not necessarily slow, which is why I've got the picture of the crocodile here. Most of the time, when you see a crocodile, it's just sitting there and sunning itself and doesn't seem to be doing anything. But when it needs to move, it can. So I want to talk another thing that we've done about jets. This is the Rutherford experiment. And by Rutherford, I mean it was done by his graduate students, Geiger and Marsden. This is the same Geiger as in Geiger counter, which was invented by his graduate student, a guy named Mueller. So, you know, there is credit. It's just you always get it for the thing one generation later. So he took alpha particles. They smacked them into a gold foil, and they saw them in a scintillation counter, which they were able to vary. And in the existing model, the Thomson model, the electric field that the alpha particle experiences gets weaker and weaker and weaker the more into the atom that you go. On the other hand, if you have a nucleus in there, it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So there's a qualitative difference about what's going on here. Now, this is the result of the Geiger-Marsden experiment. This is the Thomson model, the original model they were going after. This is where their data is on the red. Right. Now, I like showing this because although you read in your textbooks that the data and the theory didn't agree, it's rare that they show exactly how bad this is. Right? Even astronomers would call this disagreement. You don't have a joint physics astronomy department here, do you? There's about a factor of a million between the two predictions here. So what we see here is an excess of events with a large angle scatter, right? And that means your probe has gone deep into the target and hit something hard and heavy on the inside. In modern language, we might say excess of large angle scatters. We might say excess of large transverse momentum scatters. It's the same thing, right? There's just too many things that bounce out at high angles. So what does our data look like? Well, the first thing you should have taken from that plot is I had to draw it on an exponential. Right? And we hate exponentials because it puts all the data in one spot. Let's try and smooth this out. So we do a change in variables, and we make it so that if there's no new physics, this should be almost flat. And if there is new physics, you see something more like the dashed line here. So in the last point or the last line or two, you'll see an upward trend at low chi. Well, you can see the data are consistent with being flat. And from that, we can extract a limit. Again, unfortunately, we didn't see anything. There's no quark substructure at a scale less than 9.5 TeV. That length scale is about 22 zeptometers, 22 times 10 to the minus 21 meters. So that's how close we're able to get in. Now, our expected limit is 5.7 TeV. And you might say, well, gee, how did you do a factor of 2 better than you expected? And the reason is we're actually not sensitive to lambda. We're sensitive to 1 over lambda squared. So you're actually looking at two numbers that are closer together than you think. As you get very close to zero, that is, as this line gets very close to flat, it becomes difficult to distinguish almost flat from almost flat. So to put it in context, if an atom were the size of the Earth, nucleus would be the size of the CN Tower. Actually, that would be a big and skinny nucleus, like U-238. You know, hydrogen nucleus is like something down like that. Previously, we knew that quarks had to be smaller than about a grape, and we've now moved from the grape to about a pea. All right. And ultimately, when we have all of our data at the highest energy, we'll reach a sensitivity about the size of a single sprinkle on a Pop-Tart. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work we've done with heavy ion collisions. We run for 1 month per year running lead on lead collisions. You can see here, you know, when you collide big heavy nuclei, you get, you know, just huge blast of particles produced, typically several thousand. So suppose these quarks scatter. All right, so when they scatter because momentum is conserved, we're going to have relatively equal momenta. And imagine it happens in this geometry. It happens near the surface of the nucleus. So one of the jets goes out, and the other one goes into the medium. All right, so nothing is going to happen to this guy because it's just flying there. But this guy has a chance to interact with the nucleus. So what will happen is this guy may lose energy. And the energy loss depends on the heat capacity of the material that you've created. The higher the heat capacity, the more energy that you can suck out, and the faster it cools. Right? If you have a quark gluon plasma, the number density of the particles that participate is large, so your heat capacity is large. So this is a way of seeing, do you have a quark gluon plasma, or are you looking at ordinary nuclear matter? This is a previous experiment's data, which I won't explain now. What we see are ordinary dijet events, this jet and this jet, which is this guy over here and this guy over here, on top of this big soup of the rest of the collision. All right, so that's, you know, I've showed you similar results in PP. But we also see guys like this, a very asymmetric event. So this jet looks normal, as if it were produced near the surface. You can see it over here. This jet that it's recoiling against has almost disappeared. You can see it's been spread out over a very wide energy, and you can't spot area, and you can't even spot its energy in the detector. So we notice this online. Just as we're running the data in real time, watching these events, we're seeing these events come in. And this is fairly typical. This is, I think it was the third event that we scanned. And this is far from unique. Here's another case. Right? So you've got one jet over here, and whatever's happening on the other side, if there's anything at all, it's pretty diffuse. You can see maybe a little bit of a remnant over there. In tracks, you can see, again, just this one guy. So the next step is to try and quantify this. So how does this depend on properties of the event? So the first thing we try to do is characterize the event. In the field, the term is centrality. Do I have a head-on collision between the two lead nuclei, or do I have a glancing blow? So if I've got a central collision or a peripheral one. So we've measured the total energy produced. We use the forward calorimeter, again, built here, to try and characterize the events into the top 10%, the most central collisions, and then going more and more peripherally over there. And it doesn't matter what we use. This is two different possible measurements of this, and you see they're very strongly correlated. We're really looking at properties of the event itself, not anything else. And we also want to quantify the effect, and since we don't know any better, we just look at the asymmetry, right? The difference in the jet energies over their sum. So I'm looking at more and more central collisions, and I'm plotting the asymmetry versus the expectation. And what you see is, as you go to more and more central events, the asymmetry, this data here, goes more and more towards large values. All right, so the more central the collision is, the more energy the second jet is losing as it's penetrating the medium. So what does this mean? Well, this is when I fall back to being an experimenter. We wrote a paper that focused on observation. This is what we see, and no matter whether the interpretation is right or wrong, this is a fact. This is how nature behaves. But if you want to interpret this as energy loss in the medium, the degree is enormous. It's a few tens of GeV in 12 fermis. This is much more than you'd expect for ordinary nuclear matter. Now, I don't like talking about temperature in cases where we're not at equilibrium, but this corresponds to a cooling rate, if you do this, of 10 to the 37 kelvins per second. So the irony here is the world's hottest substance turns out to be the world's best refrigerator. All right, so for the last topic, I want to talk a little bit about the Higgs mechanism. He used to be president. So imagine I could elastically scatter beams of W bosons. This is something which can be calculated, and by calculated I mean not by me, by trained professionals. And at high enough energy, they say the cross-section violates unitarity, which is a fancy way of saying the probability of a scatter exceeds 1, which is clearly nonsense. Worse, it means the probability of no scatter goes negative. Right? So you know, clearly the theory has problems. And it turns out the troublesome piece is, again, this longitudinal spin state. High enough means about a TeV, and it turns out that at 14 TeV, the design energy of the LHC, you're just about where you want to be to study this. So the standard model is a low energy effective theory. We know that it breaks above a TeV. Something new has to happen, and the LHC is positioned in the place to take a look and see what that is. So let me talk a little bit about spontaneous symmetry breaking. So I want to connect these four cities with railroad tracks. What's the least amount of track I need? Well, here's a bad option. I can put four pieces of track here. Now I can get from any city to any other. But if you think a little bit more, you say, ah, but I can do that in three, and I can still get from this guy to this guy by going this way. Now, here's the solution that looks optimal, but really isn't, right? Is that if I have this X, I can go from any one to any other by this hub and spoke, and this requires 2√2. But in fact, this is the true optimal solution. It takes 1 + √3. So notice that the symmetry of the solution is lower than the symmetry of the problem. So the problem has fourfold symmetry, but the solution only has twofold symmetry. Right? This is the definition of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, before you get too worried, realize that I've got another solution where it's horizontal instead of vertical. So the sum of the solutions maintains the symmetry of the problem, even though the individual solutions do not. Pointless aside, just because I like making it. You could have guessed at the answer by looking at soap bubbles, because soap bubbles are trying to minimize their total surface area, and they form 120-degree vertices. So you could have guessed the answer. Another example of spontaneous symmetry breaking is ferromagnetism. Right? The Hamiltonian is fully spatially symmetric, but the ground state pulls out one direction to be preferred. So the magnetization points in some direction or other. So what is this? Actually, let me have some water and then tell you what the Higgs mechanism is. So let's start by writing down a theory of massless weak bosons. There is nothing wrong with this theory, except it doesn't describe the world that we live in. Now we're going to add, you have to still worry about these problems. I'm going to add a new doublet of spin zero particles, and by doublet I mean four. So I've got one doublet plus its antiparticles. And I write down the interactions between the new doublet and itself and the new doublet and the weak bosons in just the right way to break the symmetry spontaneously, so the Higgs field develops a non-zero vacuum expectation value, just like the magnetization in a ferromagnet, and it allows something really, really cute to happen. And the really cute thing is the massless W plus and the massless phi plus mix. So instead of having two particles that are both massless, I have one particle that has three spin states. And remember, spin one particle with three spin states has mass. So the W has spontaneously acquired a mass. The same thing happens with the W minus and the phi minus. In the neutral case, it happens for one neutral combination, and that becomes the mass of Z. But there's another combination which doesn't couple to the photon. So the photon remains massless, and I've got 1 degree of freedom left over. And because the Higgs field has a non-zero vacuum expectation value, that leftover piece is massless. So how cute is this? It's my nephew. There's really very little choice in how you write down this theory. There's one pre-parameter, which determines the Higgs mass. There's one sign, which determines whether the symmetry breaks or it doesn't. And that's it. This theory keeps its fingers off most of the standard model, so it doesn't destroy any measurement that you've already made and agrees. It adds a new Higgs boson, which we can look for, and it adds one new piece to the WW scattering cross-section. This piece interferes destructively with what's already there, just enough to restore unitarity. And in this model, the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field is the Fermi constant within a root 2 or so. So this is why the weak force is weak, why the sun shines for billions of years. It's the Higgs mechanism which stabilizes the lifetime of the sun. Now, we know how this behaves, so we know what to search for. At one particular mass, we'd expect to see it in two photons. At another mass, see it in two Zs. There's channel after channel after channel. And if you combine them all, this is how much luminosity you need in inverse femtobarns. We're sitting right here at the very bottom right now. This region has been excluded by the Tevatron at Fermilab. This has been excluded by LEP over at CERN. And everything in between is fair game, although the farther up you go, you start to get some tension with some indirect measurements. So we're looking at getting some number between 1 and 2 inverse femtobarns by the end of this year, and another several, perhaps at a slightly higher energy, which puts you up perhaps over here by the end of next year. So for much of the mass range, within the next 2 years, we'll not just see the Higgs, but we'll be able to start seeing it in multiple channels. So we can ask the question, not just does it look like a Higgs, but does it behave like one? I don't want to let you walk away with the idea that all that matters is the Higgs mechanism, because it's possible that it's just completely wrong. One possibility is I didn't have to stop with one Higgs doublet. Remember, one doublet is four. I could have added two, which gives me another four, so I'd have five particles I could look for. Usually some of them are hard to see, but some of them are usually easier. And you don't have to stop. You can add triplets or lots of doublets. You can, you know, play this game over and over again. Or you might see something in new strong dynamics. Maybe the fact that this cross-section is blowing up is telling us something. This is the pion-proton cross-section, and Fermi looked at this, just the part going up, and realized if it went up, it had to come down somewhere. So he discovered this resonance, the delta, without ever actually seeing the peak. He just knew it had to happen. Right? There may be resonances among the W's and Z's which explicitly break the symmetry. We don't know. There are many models, and the data that we're about to collect is going to tell us what's what. I'm told never start a talk with an apology, so I will end with one. I didn't cover even 10% of what we've done. I didn't talk about precision measurements. I didn't talk about top quarks, even though we're producing top quarks at a rate far beyond the Tevatron. I didn't talk about some of our searches for new particles. In particular, we have the possibility of producing particles of dark matter, the thing that makes up such a large fraction of the universe. Searching for extra dimensions, why is gravity such a weak force compared to all of the others? You know, gravity can break your arm, but it takes you an entire planet to do it. Right, that gives you an idea of how weak it is. Are there mini black holes that we can make? Why is the universe made out of matter? All of these things ATLAS can make some sort of statement on. Right now, we've published 27 results. We have 12 drafts in the middle of collaboration review and 21 in the pipeline, plus 100 preliminary results for conferences. So, to conclude, electroweak symmetry breaking it's a mystery. Right? You know, we've been asking this question in one form or another since 1860, right? Why is the weak force so weak? Why is the sun so old? And I think the LHC is in a very, very good position to shed light on this. This no-lose theorem means something has to happen. Maybe it's a Higgs, maybe it's something else, but we know that the theory we have is not just incomplete, it's actively wrong at these energies, and this will let us see what the truth really is. And any experiment that you build to do this can answer, you know, a whole horde of other questions. And I just looked at a few. For example, are quarks fundamental, or might they have substructure? And while it was a rough start, I think we're now starting to produce results well beyond what we've achieved before, and this year and next promise to even be better. So thank you very much for your attention, and thank you very much for inviting me.